Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, man, welcome to the K-Thompson Live Show. I'm the co-host, one of the co-hosts, Eric Payne, along with Wayne Gilman. I'm going to be hosting the show by myself tonight, Wayne, and I guess we'll have George Stanley calling in and maybe Mal Wolfo. A couple of things I want to talk about, you know, a bunch of stuff going on in the news. We had the Pope here last week, and he just cut out trying to spread some joy and faith to people, trying to get people to do the right thing and keep all those things in check that keep coming out, people keep bringing out of you. But he's Pope tried to do some good things. And, of course, the Republicans, if you notice, they all had problems with him. There's a whole bunch of clips on that you can find on YouTube and Facebook about all these guys talking about. One guy was talking about his job is to get people, get souls into heaven, not tell governments how to operate, as if that's a little bit more important than getting into heaven, I suppose. But they're all of them. I mean, Hannity, a bunch of them. I've never heard in my lifetime. I don't know, maybe some of you folks out there have heard in your lifetime people going crazy. The Pope, maybe when it was around when John Kennedy got elected, and it was a remarkable thing or accomplishment for a Catholic to be president. But not since those days have I heard people coming out with, and these are supposed to be, you know, the people who support the Republican, the right, the conservative, the Christian, the evangelical, or whatever, the conservative, whatever they were, all those labels they call themselves to make themselves sound right. They're supposed to be those people. And they were dogging the Pope. But maybe that's before they found that the Pope met with the girl Kim Davis, the lady who wouldn't let the gay folks get married. So maybe they'll pull back on them a little bit. I'm sure on the conservative channels, they have a, you know, they're probably kind of going a little bit light on them now because it's something that they like, you know, but it's just really remarkable the vitriol that some of these people have in, you know, trying to get things done in our country and how they vilify and make everybody else seem like the enemy and just evil. It's really unbelievable some of their reactions to things going on. So what else? I'm sorry, I am a little distracted trying to figure out some things going on in our studio. I have a little trouble, some technical difficulty with my mouse here. And with tonight's guest, we're going to have George Stanley call in. We were going to, he and my mom were going to talk about his book. She's a little bit under the weather. So we're going to be talking to George. He can give us a synopsis of his book and how he came up with the idea. Still having a little bit of trouble with this mouse. I'm trying to get open the mic. I see that we have our co-host Wayne Gilman calling in, and we also have George Stanley. So I'm going to open the mic. Wayne Gilman, come on in. Wayne, how are you doing today?
How are you doing? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Say that again. I mean, I guess that's the reason you asked me if I can hear you, because the way you just sounded on the phone. Say that again one more time.
Can you hear me better now?
I can hear you a little bit better now.
Okay, great. If not, I'll call back on another line if it's not clear, you know. How's everything?
Everything's going all right. You know, just talking about the Pope being in town and how, you know, I happened to come across somebody edited some clips together of all of the news agencies and pretty much most of the people on Fox, kind of coming down on the Pope because of a lot of the things that he was talking about, the environment, respecting the environment, he's pro-global warming and immigration. And so they had a little, I was telling people that they had a little little reel of all these hosts on Fox and these news people, the Fox personalities, really going in on the Pope. And so one guy was talking about it's the Pope's job to get souls into heaven, not to tell the governments how to run. And it was just kind of, for the first time in a long time, hearing people really disrespect the Pope or even his right to express his opinion, you know?
Well, You're absolutely right, Eric. I mean, I only watched the Fox coverage at the very end. I happened to be an acquaintance or somewhat of a fan of Jeanine Pirro, the former Westchester County District Attorney, who's a judge, and she's one of the hosts. And the thing is that politically we're not always on the same page, but, you know, she's a devout Catholic, and I was surprised that she was probably one of the few hosts over there who had nothing critical to say. This Pope has been a breath of fresh air. I grew up Catholic. I went to Catholic schools. You know, I've experimented with different faiths, but Catholicism has always been my comfort zone from the time I was a child. I can't help it. What I like about this Pope is that he's reaching out to everybody. It doesn't matter what faith you are, you know. And he really resonated on a number of issues: immigration, the climate, the economy, the wars that are going on. All these issues are issues that all of us in this world are facing. And for the first time, I don't know what happened last week. Maybe it was the intense police security in New York, but there was just a moment of civility and respect for your fellow man out here like I had not seen before. And I guess that could be said the same for New Jersey or anywhere where the Pope was in proximity.
Right. People decided to have a little bit of respect. Can you hear me all right? All right, Wayne, I plugged in another microphone. You can hear me okay, right? I switched. I just put an earpiece in just with a little bit better microphone scenario. So I just wanted to double check, make sure you could hear me clearly. But, yeah, I concur with what you're saying, that, you know, people seem to be a little bit more kind in the United States, for at least for those few moments that the Pope was actually around. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the Fox Network is in New York City, so I guess for that day that he was here, I guess they reserved. I don't know when that clip was put together, but I know it was done after he gave the speech to the joint session of Congress, and these people were really going after him, surprisingly. I was surprised, actually. I was kind of shocked. I'm not Catholic or anything.
I'm surprised. I thought that many of the Republicans got their wish for Boehner to step down, and obviously Boehner had given that a lot of thought before he decided to take action. So now the field is wide open. The conservatives should have nothing to complain about. You know, they could go after, they could shut the government down, they could give the Democrats hell. They've certainly succeeded in making Hillary Clinton somewhat silent as far as her contest is concerned, you know, over these emails, which to me is like a nothing issue. But the bottom line is that it's going to be a very interesting contest. And the last thing I heard on the way in here tonight is that Donald Trump, their number one contender, is seeking Oprah Winfrey's help as a possible vice presidential candidate, you know, if he should get the nomination. Amazing. I didn't know.
That's going to make him automatically. I hope that, I don't know if that's a rumor or not, but that will automatically sink his campaign into the ground. Those Republicans, those people are going to go for Oprah. They just got one black. They got to dust off and clear off the furniture as far as they're concerned. After they get the president and his family out, they're not going to let Oprah come in there and with all our stuff, because she'll have Michelle and Barack over to visit, I guess, at least to the Blair house. But, Trump is, he's willing to do anything, willing to say anything. And after, you know, after the first 5 minutes of listening to him speak, I was listening to his address tonight a little bit where he's in New Hampshire. But after the first 5 minutes hearing, and if you heard it all before, you hear him pushing himself for president and talking about the issues a little bit. But it's so overwhelmed by him stroking himself and bragging every other sentence, you know. It's like,
exactly.
Yes, we can do this, and of course I could do it because I'm the best, or they love me, or I'm on the face of every magazine. It's like, who cares, man? Who cares about you and your money? I mean, it really is, after a minute, I mean, you know, he's entertaining on TV. You know, The Apprentice is great, but it's really, I think, it's really a statement about our society now, and it's celebrity gone like in overdrive, and also this social media and how we're enthralled with people on TV and celebrity, because a lot of these people that seem to be in the flyover or whatever, which is the middle part of the country, I don't even want to say that, people who aren't quite as savvy about the issues and what's going on in the world, and I believe people who let their prejudice and their racism and their fear get in the way of reasonable thinking. And so these are the people that seem to be attracted to Donald Trump, you know, the ones that watch TV and this guy's The Apprentice, they've seen him on their list. I mean, and that's not only those type of people, it's the majority of the country is dumbed down, not aware of the issues, not aware, can barely, I mean, you know, you see these late night shows where the hosts do these little skits where they ask people to identify, you know, the vice president, secretary of state, various people, and the average person doesn't even know what these people look like. Which means that they pay very little attention to the news. You know, it's like, do you ever pick up a newspaper or read the news or wonder about your taxes or why they're talking about climate change or, you know, and these guys are still denying climate change when they're having these crazy floods in Florida. So it's unbelievable what they're willing to do to get their point across. Also, I'm moving over to another area. Did you happen to see any of the testimony by the lady who was head of Planned Parenthood, Ms. Richards, yesterday?
I know there's been an uproar. I know Congressman Rangel here in New York had a news conference on the steps of City Hall. The First Lady of New York, she also participated. And, you know, there's really an effort on the part of the Republicans to deep six that whole agenda there. And, you know, it's almost like as if these people have blood in their eyes. I'm waiting to see what's going to happen with the economy and you know, what these banks are going to do if the Republican Party should get in there, you know? I'm also concerned about these wars that are taking place, particularly this issue with Syria and how that's going to affect, you know, the Democrats, because, of course, they're going to blame everything on Obama, not looking at the big picture of how the United States got deeply involved in the Middle East, you know, long before Obama was president, you know? So,
yeah, well, that's their MO, right? That's what they always do. They want to go, their memory is only as short, like, you know, they want to blame him for the economy's not getting that much better now. It's not improving like they said. It's this, is that. Wait a minute. He inherited, you know, I mean,
exactly.
He inherited the worst recession in history, and he's building it back up. And you guys have the gall, the nerve, to talk about the economy is not where it is, really? And then to have Jeb. If I was Jeb Bush, I would have a hard time deciding to run for president. How can you run for president I'm sorry, say that again?
No, I happen to agree. I mean, you used a term just a moment ago I had never heard before, and I think that it's so excellent, the flyover, because the bottom line is, you know, no one knows what's going on in the middle of the country to a certain extent, and everyone is directly affected. And I've always had this perception, because I've driven cross country, that anything west of Oklahoma is just open land. I mean, the deal is that if you wanted to fit another country, another state, another country in the United States, there's plenty of space in this country for people to go live in. And the climate isn't all that bad. It's just whether or not starting an economy, who's going to be first to be a pioneer going into the area and stuff like that. But the term flyover is excellent, because there are a lot of people who just have not a clue of what goes on and how other people live, I mean, except in their respective jurisdictions. And some of the things that they come up with, I remember that gathering that Trump had in Texas over there about his views on immigration. And then the way he handled or did not decide to handle a heckler, I forgot, somewhere in the Midwest he was making an appearance, and somebody brought up the whole Bertha issue with Obama being a Muslim and not from the United States. He stood there stone-faced and didn't respond to the guy until 2 days later, and he said, oh, you know, he figured out a clever way to respond to the criticism for not responding by not saying anything at all. He still stirs trouble. But the thing is that, you know, people have got to realize, I understand how there may be a frustration with the seasoned politician and that they want people who don't know, but you got to be careful about who you pick. I even am concerned about the one black that they have there in the Republican Party, you know, among the field of candidates there. I'm all of a sudden driving through parts of some of the wealthiest sections of Westchester County here in New York. I mean, people who control Wall Street, the banking industry, the whole bit. And I see signs for Ben Carson. And everything is based on healing and bringing the country together. Somebody who's sound. I mean, I couldn't believe I drove through two neighborhoods, Scarsdale which is one of the wealthiest communities in New York and the country, let alone, and parts of Rye. And I'm just seeing passing homes, and I'm just seeing signs for Carson, and I'm just saying, you know, maybe some years ago it wasn't even acceptable for a black to be on anybody's ticket. And all of a sudden, now that they've had 8 years of Obama, you know, and I'm not saying the guy is entitled to his opinions, but what bothered me the other day is that while the Pope was here, he had the audacity to come out of his mouth and say a Muslim should not be president. You know? it's amazing.
He's a special individual, Ben Carson.
I don't know.
He's remarkable. He's remarkable in some of the things he says. I mean, just that come out of his mouth. And I think that he has a kind of a little God complex himself, you know, it's his surgery sometimes. But just his way that he feels like, I have a brain and I can figure things out. It's, come on, man. I know you're a doctor and everybody should, you know. And it's almost kind of subconscious to some of these guys to be that arrogant. I guess you have to be confident. But, yeah, Ben is Ben, and he's got as his business manager. What's the other kind of guy that's very conservative?
I know who you're talking about.
But Armstrong Williams.
Williams, oh, please. Jeez Louise.
So, I mean, yeah. You know, there's a whole African-American perspective, I think, that kind of, you know, goes along with the Republicans. And, I mean, they approach it from my standpoint, from an individual standpoint. Like, I individually was able to make it so every other black person should make it. And if they don't, oh, well, you're not trying hard enough. And they really aren't concerned about black people en masse on the collective.
Yeah.
And why, you know, there's no real testing barometer to know why some should make it and some shouldn't make it, and what the experiment of slavery has done to another race for hundreds of years and all that kind of stuff. You know, and, you know, it's still to this day. I mean, you guys used to talk about it on LIB on my mom's show, these very issues that we're facing 20 years later. And
we're still
African-Americans that are kind of toned the line. You know, I call them lawn jockeys. That's what they're doing. You know, they're toning the line for this power structure that negatively affects people that look like them on a whole. You know, let's bring in George Stanley into some of these political discussions here. And we're going to talk about his book in a minute and see if he has an opinion about some of the politics. I know he does. George Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
Hey.
Yes, hi.
How are you doing?
Yeah. Okay.
George Stanley is the author. Let me just give you a little promo. George Stanley is the author of Brick City, a novel. Actually, it was a script before a novel. He is born in North New Jersey. And he came up on the Mean Streets of Newark and Dayton Street Projects and went from there to earn an MFA from the University of California Riverside, a BA from Georgia State University. And he's between North Carolina and New Jersey. And George has written this book. So before you get off into your book, what do you think about, you know, this upcoming presidential election, George?
Well, it's very interesting, and I don't really want to take any political stand right now, especially while I have a book out. I don't want to alienate anyone.
I'm going to be honest with you. The people that would be offended by what you had to say probably wouldn't be buying a novel about some black kids in the 60s in North New Jersey. So feel free to swing away, my brother, at Donald Trump's school, at least like that.
Well, you know, I don't care for Mr. Trump, and I really couldn't see him leading this country. I could see him leading this country into the ground, or running this country into the ground, but I really don't see him as a leader. I don't see him as a president. Like you had mentioned before, The Apprentice is a pretty interesting show, but I just don't see him as being a leader in this country. And as far as the other Republican, candidates, I'm not a Republican, so I really don't, I wouldn't even consider any of them. Democratic candidates are pretty interesting. Hillary Clinton, love her. She's great. I think she would make a great president. I also think Vice President Joe Biden would make a great president, and his numbers are really rising. So it'll be interesting to see. Next year will be a very interesting year for all of us.
I was going to say about the Republican Democrat thing. You know, I mean, there's some of those guys that aren't going to get elected that have at least kind of some interesting open mind things. Governor Kasich from Ohio has said some interesting things in terms of.
What do you think about Bernie Sanders?
Bernie Sanders is a very good. He's telling it like it is, and he's. Mm-hmm, I think he's on the opposite end of the spectrum from someone like Donald Trump and those other extreme conservatives. That's why the only reason I think that he probably wouldn't get elected because of, he's an independent, and at one time he was a socialist,
right.
And they'll paint him in that perspective. So that's
right.
Why. But he's really someone who is, you can look at and say that he's for the people, and he's someone who's been walking and talking like that for throughout his career for the most part.
Absolutely, absolutely. He's a very interesting candidate.
But as I was saying, Wayne, George has a book, Brick City House. George, tell us a little bit about your book and how you came about to write it and why and stuff like that.
Okay, I didn't hear your question. What was that?
I said, tell us a little bit about Brick City, how you came to write it, what made you want to write a book.
Brick City is a story about a boy and his three friends growing up in the Newark Projects. The time is 1962. It starts out in 1962. These boys are barely teenagers. And it follows them till 1967, and it as they transition into young men. And it just tells about the things that go on in the projects, around the project. And anyone who actually lived in Newark at the time in the 60s and 70s, they either knew someone who lived in the projects or had a relative who lived in the projects or they themselves lived in the projects, because at the time 10% of the Newark population lived in public housing. And this is during the 60s and 70s where Newark population was close to 500,000. It would affect probably anyone who lived in Newark at the time, and not only that, but anyone who lives in any project throughout the United States, because this is a combination of the public housing projects, not only in Newark, but I've been to projects in New York, Miami, Atlanta, L.A., and it's the same culture, and they have the same problems. As a matter of fact, Atlanta decided to get rid of all their projects, all their public housing. And even though when I went to Atlanta, they looked like garden apartments, they didn't look like the high-rise projects that we had in Newark. But they still, like I said, they still had the same problems, and they got rid of them and demolished them for the same reasons that the city of Newark demolished them. And, you know, people always ask me why I want to tell this story. And for one thing, the projects in Newark, they don't exist anymore. Okay, even the last of the three-story projects, I hear they're demolishing the little bricks where I grew up. Half my childhood was in the Little Bricks, and then the second half was in the Kretschmer Homes, or Dayton Street Projects. And these buildings don't exist anymore. And even though they were cold and ugly, the people were warm and beautiful. And there are stories to be told. And it's a history. It's a history that is ingrained in the people of Newark. Even though they don't exist, there are still people who, you know, their parents either lived in the projects or their grandparents either lived in the projects. So this is one thing I want it to be documented. I want it to be preserved because it is a history. It's a fabric of Newark, and I just felt it should be told.
Yeah, well, I mean...
I don't mean to interrupt, but I mean it's interesting because I think there is something to be said about that, and there is a commonality as you pointed out. You know, growing up in Brooklyn and then growing up in New York, you know, I didn't realize how bad my neighborhood was until I left the neighborhood and started going to school, not even as an adult, just going to high school in a different part of the city, and said, oh, you come from there, and right away, you know, somebody has something negative to say. But it's a phenomenon that perhaps, as you pointed out, should never have been started, but those who were confined to living like that, where not everything was a bad experience. People took it for granted, and there was a certain amount of respect. But the overall perception now is that kind of lifestyle is something that they're trying to get rid of in a lot of the urban centers. And what I find interesting is that there's a privatization going. I don't know if that's happening in Newark, but, you know, a lot of these buildings have been privatized now, that they've been converted to almost luxury apartments in parts of the city.
Well, see, in Newark, they just didn't mess around. They just demolished them. They were imploded. And so they no longer exist. And like I said, and I just think that's, you know, it's a history. It's a part of Newark. It's the fabric of Newark. Like I said, a lot of people lived in these public housing projects, or their parents or their grandparents. Like I said, the story starts in the early 60s. And during the 60s, and it starts in an era where the grass was kept. You know, the buildings were clean. You know, the people, in fact, we used to take turns. Families used to take turns mopping the floors, you know. And,
wow.
You know, and it was a sense of community. It was a sense of community. And so that's how the story begins. But as it goes on to, like, 1967, things kind of deteriorated. The buildings and the grounds, they weren't maintained anymore. You know, I don't know if it was budget constraints or whatever, but, you know, they started to deteriorate. And so, you know, if your surroundings start to deteriorate, then, you know, you're going to kind of start to deteriorate. Yeah, and so that's how the story, you know, it starts out in an environment where it was a community, and then it just goes to an environment where, like, I heard your broadcast last week where you said you wouldn't even go out your home after a certain time at night. And see, and that's, yeah, and that's what that has become, you know, where people were afraid to leave their house at a certain time. You know, they weren't going to go out and get in an elevator and go through, you know, go through the lobby, or, you know, you got dope fiends in the hallways and stuff like that. So, you know, it just kind of deteriorated to that point. But I do think that anyone who lived in the project or knew anybody, or and even in any city, because like I said, it's the same culture, it's the same problem. You could go to Chicago, you could go to Miami. I mean, you could go, and I was really surprised when I went to Atlanta, and I, like I said, I saw these three-story apartments. They looked really nice. I thought they were garden apartments, but they were projects. And it was the same problems that they had in the high-rise projects. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you wanted to ask, was it a racial situation? Because, you know, you when you talked about how the lawns were neatly manicured and people were living decently, you know, we had situations like there's a section in the Bronx where there's a Jewish and an Italian enclave, but there's a housing project in the center of it. And for some reason, if you got into one of those buildings, you wouldn't run into the kind of problems that you would have on another side of the Bronx that was somewhat impoverished. And I think it really came down to race.
And you're absolutely right, because in North Newark, well, in North Newark, I don't know if they still exist, but there were projects in North Newark that were basic, you know, mostly Italian. And they were well kept. They were, you know, in fact, Frankie Valli's daughter used to live in one of the, you know, apartments out there.
I was just going to call his name because I saw an interview and he talked about he himself lived in the projects you know, that's where he got his start, basically singing in the hallways.
His mom lived there, and his daughter, his oldest daughter, lived there also for a while.
Wow.
But
if I'm not mistaken, back in the day when they were the project, the first build, those types of experiments or inside the housing was kind of an interim housing, right? You put people that were a little bit lower income or working class and try to get them
elevated to move out.
Right, elevated to move out
And
they stopped that type of project by the cities, I guess, or that type of, you know, planning, city planning kind of started, the resources started going other places in the predominantly African-American ones, right? If I'm not mistaken, a little bit of saying that.
Yeah, but not only that, because of the law, and I even touch on some of this in my book where, you know, one of the characters' father loses his job because they moved to Texas. You know, he had been there so many years, and he was hoping to become a supervisor, and they just up and moved, you know. And so, you know, and he was saving for a house and all of this. But then after that happened, what can you do? And then, you know, at that time, other you know, plants and other jobs were moving out of Newark. So they were kind of stuck. And then the thing is, too, you know, if it's no opportunities, they started to have second and third generation families in the projects. You know, you have one family, and then, you know, and it might wind up to be a single mother, and then her daughter has a baby, and she gets an apartment in the project, and then that baby has a baby. So, you know, it just became a vicious cycle. And, instead of trying to move out and better themselves and get a house or something, you know, they just wanted to get an apartment. They're happy to just get an apartment in the project. You know, I got my own apartment now, you know. So I think it is a good thing that Newark got rid of the public housing. At least they, you know, won't have that problem, second and third generation public housing. But and then, too, the ills, and you know, in the latter years, with the crime and all and drugs and stuff, it just became overwhelming.
Yeah, those areas, I mean, that's something that's been going on for years. I mean, that era when those projects went up, you had them in Chicago and various other places throughout the country, New York, and all of them, I guess, were under the same kind of urban renewal plan. It was something that happened, you know, even our parents' age. You know, my mother talks about where they grew up, in the pioneer homes were kind of nice garden apartments. It was kind of that, I guess, that mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And there were colored
But that was the same thing. It was, you know, when they were first developed, they were nice. Good, decent people lived there. People wanted to take care of their property. People wanted to move up and take care of the environment they did. And that was what was experienced by my mom and her family at the time. And it was, it was something that's been done throughout the history of the United States in terms of trying to help, you know, plans about housing, cities and urban renewal, I guess, and things like that. And like you said, after a while, probably under some different administrations, the funding for those type of programs, those kind of great society programs that were put forth by Lyndon Johnson and Democrats back then, probably that funding, you know, you get new administration and Republicans and new people with different priorities, you know.
Absolutely.
That money doesn't go to those
pouring that money. Absolutely. And they don't really care. They don't really care. And even though, you know, they may not be the North Housing Authority, like you said, it's coming down from HUD and, you know, other places where their funding is cut. So they really can't do things. I tell you, when I was young, growing up in the Little Bricks, one of my best friends was a Caucasian. I mean, one of my mother's best friends was a Caucasian, you know. And slowly they started moving out. Even when I moved to Dayton Street, my best friend was a Caucasian, and they were half the floor I lived on was Caucasian. But eventually they started moving out because of the problems that they were having, you know, with the other residents and also with just the basic services that were available. You know, the mailbox gets broken and it doesn't get fixed, you know. So, and these people at that time, they're waiting for checks, you know. It's like,
right,
okay.
But you talk about some individuals who happen to be Caucasian and might have lived in those environments, you know. America was a place where mobility was much easier for them, you know.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
Like,
so, yeah.
That's I mean, that goes along with the whole kind of white flight.
Right. Right,
in the late 60s, early 70s, we had a lot of Caucasians moving to the suburbs out of the urban centers in cities across the country.
Yeah,
absolutely
right. And the ones left behind were just stuck. You know, they had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So, but I really think this book, it just needed to be written. It needed to, just like I said, document and just have a historical, and it's a fiction, of course, but it's, you know, it's some of my experiences and a combination of people I've known and things like that. So, but it's something that I think everyone should read, especially if you're from North, or especially if you've ever had any association with a housing project anywhere around the country, because like I said, they're all the same. I don't know. I just seem to be drawn towards housing projects. I feel at ease at them. You know, some people get a little skittish going into a project, you know, but like I said, I've been around the country.
Your book, if I'm not mistaken, if I may, it also captures a moment in history, too, that's indicative to that. It captures when those projects were first built, right, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
No, it's not. They've been around for a while in 1962.
Well,
they have been around for a good one.
Uh-huh.
Pardon?
I mean,
yeah, they have been around
Briefly
I'm
kind
sorry?
Of walk us through the historical kind of significance, because you said it takes place in the 60s, what's the time period in that? That's kind of unique, though, to this particular project life, right? I mean,
because
what
yeah,
the country
because
was
it's transitioning, like I said. Yeah, because it was transitioning from, like I said, a community and, you know, grassy areas to people just not knowing each other or being afraid of each other, and you know, the grassy areas had turned to glass and rocks, and you know, and it's just showing that transition. So the transition of the projects also shows the transition of the characters. You know, I mean, they were kids. You know, how much trouble can you get in the 12, 13 years old? But then by the time they're 17 and 18, it's a whole
other
story.
Different story. Yeah. So I wanted to find out, because, you know, I can only talk from the New York City experience, but with Newark, and you concerned about the issue with the politicians like Hugh Adonisio is a name that I'm certain that I know, Eric. If you didn't live during that period, your parents certainly knew a lot about him and all the corruption that was going on. But, when did Newark really experience a surge of black folk and people of color? Was that during the 60s? Were these people coming up north from the south? Or, you know, how did the projects become more a place that was more, and I don't want to call it as a repository, but more mm-hmm. African American. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was during that time, 60s, mostly in the 60s and then going on into the 70s. Like I said, at the time, North's population was almost 500,000. And now it's less than 200,000. So when they got rid of the projects, the people went somewhere, when they got rid of some of the areas.
A lot of African Americans, you know, part of that migration from south, from down south, you know, as was in accordance with the history of the country. So a lot of people, like we have a lot of relatives, my mom's side of the family and my father's side, people come up from Virginia, Georgia,
North Carolina.
North Carolina. So, and maybe, you know, two or three generations before George and myself's generation, people came up and migrated from up there. But it would have to have taken place or probably, you know, maybe in the early 1900s, I suppose.
I would probably say that in the mid 60s, the African American population became the majority. I would say around 52%, something like that.
Right.
And it, you know, yeah, because not long after that, we had our first African American mayor. Little after that, but we started to tip the scales. Over 50%, around the mid 60s, going into the 70s.
What are your thoughts about Newark today? I mean, compared to back then.
Eric could.
African Americans, obviously, with the election of Ken Gibson, the first African American mayor in Newark.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since then, every mayor has been black. And so
mm-hmm.
we fast forward to the Newark of today, post Cory Booker, who's an interesting element there because he wasn't originally from Newark. I don't believe he was even born in Newark. And so he had to move to get into politics, I believe.
Other than him,
every, you know, Ken Gibson from Newark, Sharp James from Newark, Laz Baraka from North, you know, born and bred people
mm-hmm.
from the city. Now we have a city government that is controlled by predominantly elected officials that happen to be African American in the city of North. And there is a large growing Hispanic population as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Conditions
have gotten better in your estimation, or do you think it's just a new phase that we're going through, or what have you?
Well, yeah, clearly since the 60s, the situation has gotten better. You know, people, obviously, I mean, George could have touched that a little bit better than I could, but, you know, in the 60s, it's like, you know, African-Americans were catching the type of hell that they were catching, and I don't think Newark was really much different. I mean, obviously, if you look at the state of African-Americans now in our modern society, it's a lot different, particularly in these towns or cities that have been had a strong black political power structure. And sometimes the drawback of that, obviously, is that you do somewhat have that crabs in a barrel effect that you have with, they say, African-Americans. But that's the type of political fighting that happens in politics. I don't think it's indicative to the black people that happen to be in politics. In Newark, all the people that are in the politics that are fighting for power happen to be African-American. So then what becomes the subject then? Who's blacker than who? Who has, you know, what's there? It's not like we're your own representative. So, okay, we got it. So then what becomes the issue? What's, you know, and I suppose if we put on a larger scale, you know, you have the African-Americans who are now Republicans, like Michael Steele, Ben Carson's, and you have African Americans who are Democrats, like of course Barack Obama, Donald Payne Jr., and other prominent African Americans. So, what's the best course for Black America? You know, it goes back to that age old, I guess that, you know, assimilate or, you know, demand your own respect. You were going to say, Jordan? Mm-hmm.
No, I was saying, quiet as it's kept, there are quite a few Black Republicans out there. I mean, I remember
in the 70s,
a family friend was a Republican, and he had all this, you know, it was a pretty big Republican machine going on, even though Democrats kind of outnumbered Republicans in Jersey, but there have been Black Republicans or those who didn't become Democratic with Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Because before him, I mean, you know, most Black people were Republicans.
Oh, yeah,
and
of course. Yeah. Part of Lincoln.
Yeah.
I mean, Abraham
yeah,
Lincoln
because of Lincoln,
there.
Right.
No, but I mean, when you move a little bit more forward, and the era you're talking about in the 60s and 70s, yeah, you had a few Black Republicans, but I think that they were moderate.
Yeah.
They just talked about Senator Ed Brooke out of Massachusetts, who was elected to be a United States Senator as a Republican, and clearly the area, mm-hmm. I believe he was in, was predominantly a white. But just mm-hmm. referred to today on some of the news shows that the Republican Party is skewing so much to the right that I think it was Tom DeLay or somebody, they said, wow, he made a statement saying he would be considered a moderate Republican, when at one time he was a far right Republican. So, you know, and the Republican Party has lost, they're commenting how the Republican Party has lost moderate or liberal Republicans like a Ed Brooke, and I would even go on to say like a Jack Kemp, and individuals like that who were Republicans back in the day. Or the Jacob Javits, or those people that started out Republican and left the Republican Party. So, you know, they've pushed so far, and it's almost like, you know, their slogans now, let's take America back, make America great again. Take it back from who?
Yeah.
And who made it ungreat?
I know, right.
Yeah.
I thought it was great, you know. When did it become ungreat, right?
Right. So
let me just say, I know you just have a few minutes left, and I just wanted to let your listeners know that Brick City, a novel by George Stanley, is available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and also iUniverse.com. It's available in paperback and ebook. So if you're into the Kindle thing, you can get it in the ebook. Just wanted to let you know
that's
that.
Great. I'm gonna pick up a copy. I'd like to hear, you know, read what that's all about, and because I miss that. You know, what I think about is what you just mentioned. Though I didn't grow up in a housing project, I lived near the Brevoort houses in Brooklyn. You know, where all the gangs were, and you know all that period. So, you know, it just takes me back into my childhood. So it should be good reading.
It sure will be. It sure will be. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I appreciate you having me on your show.
Yes, we want to thank you. Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I noticed your mother's been quiet for the past hour. Is she around or?
No, she's feeling a little bit under the weather, so that's why I'm doing it, because she's been reading a Brick City. She wanted to talk about it, so we'll be talking about it again.
She is
going to do her book club review that everybody can see on her Facebook page, where she reviews books in her book club. So she's going to be she's preparing a review for it.
Okay.
But anyway, we want to say thank you once again to George Stanley, author,
filmmaker. Thank you. You're welcome.
Man, extraordinaire man. Thanks for coming on and talking to us. And you take care. All right?
Okay, thank you.
Wayne Gilman, co-host. Sorry to cut you off a little bit there, George. Wayne Gilman, newsman extraordinary, and help us out, WLIB. You want to let people know.
Always
a pleasure with you as well.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. The hour goes by so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to have to start expanding it a little bit. Maybe an hour and a half. We can expand the conversations and get more people involved. We want to say thanks once again to everybody that's listened in tonight. Always remember, you can listen to the K Thompson Live Show on the blogtalkradio.com network. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/K Thompson Live. You can listen to the show, all the archives, all the old shows. You can also listen to us live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. here on the Blog Talk Radio. And that's it. Wayne, good night. I'm out of here too.
All the best. Good night.
Thank you, sir. Take care, everyone. Good night. And see you.